Let's refocus, because I figured if we start on time, maybe we can encourage people to the rest of the people to come on time.
Are you a yet?
No, but I've often been accused of being one.
Well, that's
what
he says.
That's right. I'm a Litvak Yeki wannabe. What can I do? Okay, so I promised you a little bit of myth busting, and today you're going to get it. We have, in our introduction to Yehoshua so far, we have focused specifically on Yehoshua and on the appropriateness or the role that Yehoshua plays in relationship to Moshe, and on the choice of Yehoshua as the leader because of his connection to Moshe, the continuity for Moshe, etc. What we haven't addressed is the broader historical significance of the leadership of Yehoshua, specifically in the context of him being from Shevet Ephraim. What I wanted to address today is the role of Shevet Ephraim and Shevet Menashe specifically as the children of Yosef in the leadership of Israel, because that's a piece that links us back all the way to Sefer Bereishit, where the struggle for the leadership of the tribes of Israel is essentially a struggle between two anchors, Yehuda on the one hand and Yosef on the other. Much has been written and said about the tug of war between Yosef and Yehuda over the leadership of the tribes of Israel. It essentially becomes the central motif of the second half of Sefer Bereishit. And historically, it does play out in biblical history through the establishment of Malchut Yisrael from Shevet Yehuda, the establishment of Malchut Yisrael from Shevet Ephraim, because Ephraim is the leadership of the northern kingdom of Israel. The Navi calls the northern kingdom of Israel the kingdom of Ephraim. So there's a back and forth between these two tribes as far as the leadership of Israel is concerned. The question is the appropriateness of choosing the leader, the next leader of Israel, the successor to Moshe, from Shevet Ephraim, when intuitively you would have thought that the appropriate tribe from which to draw on the leadership of Israel would have been Shevet Yehuda. Certainly in terms of Yaakov's blessings to his children, there is there's an element of identifying Yehuda as the future leader of Israel. Lo yasu shevet mi Yehuda mochokek mi ben raglav. The shevet is the shevet of the scepter of leadership that will always remain in Judah. And it raises a question as to why the first leader of Israel, in that first generation as they come into the land of Israel, why that first leader of Israel would have been chosen dafka from Shevet Ephraim. Ephraim being essentially another way of choosing Yosef, because Ephraim is designated by Yosef as the successor, if you will. If you remember the issue of the firstborn, I spoke about this briefly Shabbos afternoon. Sefer Bereishit has a number of themes that run through it, but one of them is the anti-firstborn agenda. Every bechor in Sefer Bereishit loses his bechorah. And that's not an accident. Who is Abraham's Bechor? Yishmael. And the birthright goes to Yitzchak. Who is Yitzchak's Bechor? Esav. Birthright goes to Yaakov. Yaakov's Bechor? Reuven. Birthright gets split, but primarily goes to Yehuda and to Yosef. The double portion goes to Yosef. The leadership goes to Yehuda. Yosef's firstborn. Levi doesn't get any share. Yes, but Levi doesn't get any share in the birthright of the classic issue of the Bechor. The classic issue of the Bechor is either a function of leadership or a double portion, the P-Shnayim, which is given to Yosef. And it's actually a pasuk in Divrei Hayomim that says explicitly that the birthright, the Bechorah, was taken from Reuven and given to Yosef, because he's the only one who gets the double portion. Of Yosef's two children, Ephraim and Manasseh, the older is Menashe. And who does Yaakov bless with the right hand and the position of leadership? Ephraim. So from Avraham until Ephraim, there is a basic anti-Bechor agenda. The Bechor never gets his birthright as the Bechor. There's a reason for it. There's a subtext there, that it's a function of what you deserve and not necessarily a function of how you're born into the family. The birthright concept gets minimalized in the Torah, in Halacha, reduced to a Pishnayim concept rather than in its broader historical context of what the first birthright was all about. So Ephraim is really the designated representative of Yosef, and by choosing the leadership of Israel from Ephraim, essentially the leadership was chosen from Shevet Yosef rather than from Shevet Yehuda. I would not have expected the leadership to come from Shevet Reuven, because, as we said, that parsha ends in Sefer Breshit, nor would I have expected the leader to come from Shevet Levi, because the leader has to be a warrior and go off to battle and be the general, and Shevet Levi did not fight in the army. Right? They were designated to be in the temple. So with the exception of Moshe, the leader can't come from Levi, certainly not going to come from Shimon. That's self-explanatory. So what we're left with is the potential of Yehuda, and that's essentially what Yaakov says in his bracha to his children, that lo yaso shevet miyuda, leadership will come from Judah. He also attests some quality of leadership to Yosef. The role of Yosef in Mitzrayim is very clear. There was a role of leadership to Yosef. And Jewish history has essentially revolved around, certainly biblical history, these two anchors of leadership: tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Judah, to the point where when the kingdom split, you have two kingdoms, one from each of these tribes. And we even have a concept in messianic terms. The Chazal talk about Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Chazal talk about a two-stage redemption process. Stage one. Stage one, almost as a reliving or a repetition of what happened in Egypt when we went down to Egypt. Stage one is Mashiach ben Yosef, which is a physical redemption of Israel. And stage two is the spiritual redemption of Israel, represented by Yosef and Yehuda. So my question is how we ended up going into Eretz Yisrael under the leadership of Shevet Ephraim. Simple question. Now you could argue, and we could have a simple answer to that question, that it is essentially the same model that we used when we went down to Egypt, and that I just described in the context of redemption, namely, that Yosef represents the physical protection of Israel, the physical redemption of Israel, and Yehuda represents the spiritual legacy of Israel. And what you have in that paradigm is a stage one and a stage two at every step of the way. We went down to Egypt. Yosef was the one who brought us down to Egypt, l'michiyash l'chani alechem, to provide sustenance and food. And then ultimately Yehuda comes down to l'harot be'eretz Goshen, to instruct them in the land of Goshen. When we talk about Yimot HaMashiach, in the time to come, we also have this split paradigm. Yosef preparing the physical foundation of the land of Israel, and ultimately Judah will come in to provide the spiritual sustenance, a concept which Rav Kook played on significantly in a very famous address called Misped B'Yerushalayim. If you have not seen it, I actually have an English translation of it, in which it was the eulogy he delivered on the occasion of the moving of Herzl's grave from Basel to Yerushalayim. When they set Herzl's grave in Yerushalayim, Rav Kook gave a very famous eulogy in which he alludes to, he comes about this close to saying it, he doesn't quite say it, but it's very clear that was his intent, where he calls Herzl Mashiach ben Yosef. Because of this paradigm, the physical redemption versus the spiritual redemption, Yosef representing the physical, Yehuda representing the spiritual, and eventually the two mix. A powerful, powerful eulogy. draws on biblical imagery of Achav and Yoshiyahu, and it's a whole study in Tanakh. One year I'll find an occasion, we'll actually sit down and read it through and learn it through. It's really quite remarkable. So one could argue, and legitimately so, that that's essentially what happened when we went into the land of Israel. The Shevet Ephraim, or Yosef in that regard, was essentially the representative of the physical leadership of Israel, the laying of the foundation of the conquest of the land, the war with the nations, the security of the borders, all of the requirements for the physical foundation of Israel were to be laid down by Mashiach ben Yosef, or in this case Yosef. And then, at a later stage, we would imbue that kingdom with a spiritual identity through the establishment of the leadership of Israel, or leadership of Judah, and Malchut Yehuda. I'm not completely satisfied with that answer, even though I think it's, in some level, correct, because Yosef, in this case, Ephraim, and in this particular case, Yehoshua, does so much more than lay the foundation of the physical security of Israel. Yehoshua truly is not only a general and a warrior, but he really is a spiritual leader par excellence, along the lines of Moshe Rabbeinu. We'll see that towards the end of the Sefer. We'll see that in the context in which he addresses the spiritual issues in of commitment to Torah. To identify his role in the sense of the Yosef Yehuda paradigm is essentially to sell short what Yehoshua accomplished in his lifetime. So I'm looking for a different address to the question, why Dafka Ephraim? Or Ephraim and Menashe?
There's actually an NPR program today.
And NPR.
National Public Radio.
Okay.
And there was some biblical scholar, and she was talking about Yehoshua. It was very funny.
Did she say anything untoward?
No. So she was going on, like you said, about both components, the physical and the spiritual. And really, if you look on a pshat level, with what she was saying, she didn't use those words, but that is really this real cruel, warrior, and how much mass murder he commits. Oh, this whole thing. So
genocide.
So I needed to bring that up. And
ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing, right? That's the argument. Joshua is ethnic cleansing in its earliest stage. We will address that question. You cannot learn Sefer Yoshua without addressing the question of the morality of Sefer Yoshua. I once had a conversation with Dr. Norman Lamb when he was giving a lecture at one of the RCA conventions, and he was talking about issues related to the current political arena. I don't remember exactly what the context was, but I went over to him afterwards and I said, I'm teaching Sefer Yoshua. Do you have any advice for me? And he looks at me and he says, yeah, get out of Yehoshua as fast as you can. And I said, then that's not going to work, because it's 2 years in Yehoshua and 3 years in Shoftim. What am I going to do? So that solution wasn't there. But I do have an address to the question of the morality of Sefer Yoshua. We will get to it. I can't do it right at the beginning of the Sefer because there's not enough information on the table. But as we go through it, it's certainly in the curriculum. If you don't deal with that issue head on, it just dances around. It's the white elephant in the room. It is your issue. So we will address that question a little bit later. Yeah?
The other thing that I thought about, since you've been talking a lot over the last few weeks, not even about you necessarily, but about the whole idea of the leader being the shepherd, and how
we don't know his early background. That's true. But he's Moshe's disciple, so I'm prepared to take Moshe's quality and throw him onto Yeshua. The truth is, Yeshua is a fascinating study in leadership. Forgetting everything else, Yeshua is a fascinating study in leadership because I think as a leader, he was a much more effective leader than Moshe. For many reasons that aren't necessarily the fault of Moshe, but remember that Moshe is always an outsider. To the people, Moshe grew up as an Egyptian, lived in Midian till he was 80, rejoins the Jewish people at the age of 80. And much of Chumash, and much of the story of Moshe, is a tension between Moshe and Bnei Yisrael. And it manifests itself in so many different arenas from the very beginning. But you almost get a sense, despite the fact that he's on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and despite the fact that he does all these miracles, and despite everything else, there's almost, not so much a disconnect, but almost a basic mistrust of Moshe as a leader. They're prepared to accept the Torah, they're prepared to accept the laws, but this constant rebellious theme is always directed at Moshe. Why did you take us out of Egypt? Why did you do this? Why? Till the point, till Korach. And then, after Korach, there's nothing left. Moshe just lets him have it. And then we're 40 years later, and we're a new generation, beginning of Parshat Chukat, and there's no water to drink. And what do? There's another rebellion against Moshe. You almost get a sense that Moshe never is able to bridge that gap between being the outsider and the people. And the truth is, the Chazal talk about it in the sense that the Torah could have only been given by an outsider. You couldn't have the Torah been given by an insider. You needed Moshe separate from his people to come in from the outside. The very famous Ibn Ezra talks about why it was necessary for the Redeemer of Israel to come in from the outside, because he never had the slave mentality of having grown up in Egypt. Yehoshua never has that problem. Despite the fact that he's Moshe's disciple, despite the fact that he's in Moshe's tent all along, he has a certain connection to the people because he grows up there that is remarkable to see through all the challenges of Sefer Yehoshua. And there are great challenges. Yeshua is a book of war. War after war after war. Despite all the challenges, there's not one rebellion against Yehoshua. And it's not like we're in a different time period, in a different generation, and in a different place. We're the first 14 years after Moshe's death. The same generation that stood at, the same people that stood at the rock and said to Moshe, why did you take us out of Egypt? Because to make us die in the desert because there's no water from the rock. The exact same people, when the man stops flowing and they have to start working the fields and start making their own food and fighting their own battles and warring their own wars, never rebel against Yehoshua, not once. So it's a remarkable question. Is it just the fact that Yehoshua is much closer to them than Moshe was by necessity? Or is there something about quality of leadership? Everybody has different strengths. I'm going to leave that issue, but Yehoshua by and of itself is a fascinating study in leadership as a method, as a concept. But I want to come back to the issue that I raised earlier, which is why Dafka Shevet Ephraim. So we talked about why Yehoshua and his legacy to Moshe, his connection to Moshe, the loyalty to Moshe, the fact that he remains Yehoshua, he calls himself Yehoshua as his link to his master all his life. But I think the question of why Shevet Ephraim is still a relevant question. And as I said to you once before, today you're going to get, we're going to address the myth-busting of Sefer Yehoshua. Of all of the chidushim that I'm going to share with you, and of all of the novel insights that we're going to address, this is probably the most bombastic. I heard it from two sources. I've heard it from Rav Yoel Ben-Nun. I've heard it from Rav Medan. I've seen it addressed in some of the Svarim. I can't say that it's carved in stone, but it works through a number of very problematic issues, but it really is quite an enormous jump. So I will, having said that, let's jump in. We're going to go to Divrei HaYamim. We're going to go to Divrei HaYamim. Again, the question is, why Ephraim? So we're going to do a little bit of a study of Ephraim. And by the by, we're going to get to Menashe as well. We're going to lump them together. Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Zayin. We looked at these psukim earlier. This is the Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Zayin, 7, chapter 7. Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles 1, 7. Chronicles 1, 7. Or I should say 1 Chronicles. I don't like the... I told you my issue with Aleph and Bet. Starting with verse 20. The Yichus of the tribe of Ephraim. So we looked at these psukim once, in which we discovered that Yehoshua ben Nun is the grandson of... Who is Yehoshua ben Nun? He's the grandson of Elishama ben Amihud, who is the Nasi of Shevet Ephraim. That was how we got to the link between Yehoshua and Shevet Ephraim. He is, in fact, the grandson of the Nasi of Shevet Ephraim, Elishama ben Amihud. Now we're going to go back and reread this psukim from the beginning, verse 20. Bnei Ephraim, the children of Ephraim. Again, this is a section that deals with the Yichus of all of the different tribes. Are there any... Does everybody have a Tanakh? Okay, if you don't have a Tanakh, you may want to look in with somebody who does, because we're going to be all over Tanakh today. We're chapter 7, verse 20. Zayin Chaf. Ubnei Ephraim, Shitalach. Children of Ephraim. Shitalach is the first. Uvered bino, v'tachat bino, v'elada bino, v'tachat bino. V'zavad bino, v'shitalach bino, v'ezer v'elad. There's a huge discussion in the Mefarshim whether this list is horizontal or vertical. Meaning, are we discussing children of Ephraim, Shitalach, and his son Bered, and his son Tachat, and his son Elada, and his son Tachat, and his son Zev, and his son Shitalach, and then, in which case you're dealing with 7 generations, considering the fact that we're not yet at anywhere near Yehoshua ben Nun, it's problematic, because that would put something like 15 or 16 generations between Ephraim and Yehoshua, which doesn't work. Or is it a horizontal line? All the children of Ephraim or some combination thereof. Be that as it may, we end up with Ezer and Elad. Ezer and Elad doesn't say the word Beno, so the Mefarshim are in agreement that Ezer and Elad go back to Ephraim. So we have Ephraim, Shitalach, his first son, then a whole bunch of other children which are either other sons or grandchildren, and then we go back to Ezer and Elad, children of Ephraim. Vaharagum anshei Gat hanoladim ba'aretz ki yardu lakachat et miknehem. They were killed by the residents of Gat who were born in the land because they went to gather cattle or to take their cattle. Vayit abel Ephraim avihem yamim rabim. Their father Ephraim mourned for them for many days. Vayavo echav l'nachamo. And his brothers came to comfort him. Vayavo el ishto v'tahav ha'teled ben. So Ephraim and his wife have another child. Vayikra et shmo Bria, ki v'ra'a hayta b'veto. And they named the child Bria to commemorate the tragedy that had taken place, the death of the two sons, Ezer and Elad. Uvito she'era. And he has a daughter by the name of She'era. Vativen et bet chorona tachton ve'et ha'elyon ve'et uzen She'era. This daughter, by the name of She'era, builds three cities in the area around Shechem. Bet choron elyon, bet choron tachton, and uzen She'era. Three cities in the area around the city of Shechem. Then we continue the list of Ephraim's Yichus. V'refach b'no, his son Refach.
This is another son of Ephraim.
Oh, so now, again, it's back to the question of whether this lineage is horizontal or vertical. Assuming this section is definitely vertical, because we'll see we're dealing with eight generations directly to Yehoshua. So we can assume that we're back to either Ephraim's children or Shetelach's children. Vereshef, Vetelach b'no, Vetacham b'no, La'adan b'no, Amihud b'no, Elishama b'no, Nun b'no, Yehoshua b'no. So, simple question. These two children who were killed by Bnei Gat, Hanoladim ba'aretz, who were born in the land. So first of all, who does the phrase who were born in the land refer to? It's called a dangling modifier. Who does it go back to? It is a qualification of the children of Ephraim, Ezer and Elad, who were killed by Bnei Gat, and they had been born in the land. Were they born in the land of Israel at some point? Or does it refer to Bnei Gat Hanoladim Ba'aretz, the local indigenous population of Bnei Gat, indigenous to the land of Israel, came and killed Bnei Ephraim, Ezer, and Elad? I'm going to hand this out. I don't think we're going to go through this in detail, but I just leave this for you if you want it. You have the source. There's two discussions on these psukim, one in the Mefarshim and one in the Gemara, in a number of Midrashic sources, as to who exactly were these children of Ephraim who were killed. Radak raises the question of, is it, who's the Nolad Ba'aretz? Who's born in the land of Israel? Is it Ephraim's children who were born in the land of Israel? Or is it the indigenous population of Bnei Gat, who is referred to as born of the land of Israel? He offers both possibilities. The real question in this passage, and the most fundamentally important question in this passage, is when is all this taking place? That's the real issue. When does all this take place? In what generation? Because the construction of Beit Horon Elyon, Beit Horon Tachton, and Uzen She'era, three cities in the area of Shechem, by She'era, daughter of Ephraim, when does that happen? Who's mourning for the two children who were killed? Ephraim, Avihim, the father of Ephraim. So, l'chara, when is all this taking place? You tell me. What year, what generation, what context is all of this happening?
Is it before they become slaves? I mean, is there some kind of ability to go back and forth between Egypt and Israel and Ephraim?
Is it before they become slaves and there's still access back and forth between Egypt and Israel? I will hold that answer for a moment because it's quite remarkable. If you think about the consequences of what you're suggesting, it's actually quite a bombastic, novel statement that you've just made. I happen to agree with it, but it's really a revolution. And I'll tell you why, because we have to think through the consequences of what you're suggesting. But in the context of the Mefarshim, who were a little bit more hesitant to go that far, you'll find, for example, in the Radak, he asks this question. And he says, he's talking about whether the Bnei Gat Noladu Ba'aretz, if they're born in the land, he's talking, they're really a reference to the Plishtim. Then he says, fourth line, Ulefi da'ati ki anoladim ba'aretz shav l'bnei Ephraim. He says, my opinion is the Bnei Gat, the reference to those who were born in the land is a reference to the Bnei Ephraim. Lefi shezachar b'bnei Ephraim anoladim b'mitzrayim. We already mentioned the Bnei Ephraim who were born in the land of Egypt, the Hem Banav, Ubnei Banav, all of the children, as it says, Vayar Yosef Lefraim B'nei Lashim. Yosef saw three generations of children. Yosef saw his grandchildren in Egypt before he died. Amaki B'nei Ephraim and Oladim Ba'aret Sheholid Hu Ba'aret Yardu La'aretz Gat L'kachat Miknehem Ba'argum Anshei Gat. There were those who were born in the land of Israel later, and they went down to B'nei Gat, and they were killed. V'zeh Haya B'midbar. This took place in the desert, in the wilderness. Why? Ki Be'eretz Yisrael lo yuchal lihiyot. Couldn't have been in the land of Israel. Why couldn't it have been in the land of Israel? Lefi shamar vayitabel Ephraim avihem yamim rabim. Because it says that Ephraim mourned for them for many days. Ve'Ephraim lo nichnas la'aretz. Ephraim didn't go into the land of Israel. Ki lo nichnasu la'aretz miyotzei Mitzrayim miben 20 shana v'mala. They never went, those who left Egypt never went into the land of Israel. None of Ephraim. Ephraim certainly didn't go into the land of Israel. Lefichach ani omer ki maaseh hazeh haya b'midbar or b'eretz Gilad. I would suggest that this story took place either in the desert or in the land of the Gilad, outside of the boundaries of the land of Israel. And then it explains how Ephraim could be mourning for them. The two children were born in Israel, but they were killed outside of the boundaries of the land of Israel because they couldn't get into the land of Israel. Nobody goes into the land of Israel except those who leave Egypt and a generation later. Vaya adayin Ephraim chai. This story took place, says the Radak, when Ephraim was still alive. So the issue of Machir ben Menashe, I'll come back to in a moment. Skip that for now. Then he gives a textual source for his thesis, which I'll come back to a little bit later as well. And in the last line he says, V'rezal darshu, ki ze haya kodem yitziat Mitzrayim. Shemanu at haketz, v'tao v'yatzu bolo itam, v'kara lahem ze. Chazal darshan, that this has to do with a completely different episode. It has nothing to do with Ephraim, and nothing to do with the persona Ephraim. But many generations after Ephraim, in the years just prior to Yitziat Mitzrayim, Chazal have a tradition that there was a group from Bnei Ephraim that left Egypt early. They calculated the end of the redemption. They said, oh, it's time to go. They left early. They left without the rest of Bnei Israel, and they're killed along the way. They base it on these psukim in Divrei Hayamim. This is the source for the tradition that Bnei Ephraim leave early. The Gemara, and you have the source on the bottom of the page, Gemara in Sanhedrin, says that they were the bones, or at least one opinion, that they are the bones that Yechezkel revives in the famous vision of the dry bones. Mm-hmm. The dry bones of Yechezkel, the Bnei Ephraim that left Egypt early. So I have essentially two, between the Gemara and the Radak, two different approaches to who these Bnei Ephraim are who are killed. The Gemara and the traditional Midrashic source is that they are just prior, who and when, just prior to leaving Egypt, a group that leaves Egypt early, and Bnei Gat come down from Eretz Plishtim. Gat. This is essentially a large version of the map that I gave you the first class. Come down from Eretz Plishtim into the Midbar. They are killed somewhere here in the Midbar, and then Yechezkel many years later revives them. One possibility. Second possibility, the Radak says that these Bnei Ephraim we're talking about, the Menoladim Ba'aretz, is a reference to Bnei Ephraim. They were born in the land of Israel. Other children of Ephraim are born in Egypt. These children of Ephraim are born in the land of Israel. Not only are they born in the land of Israel, but Ephraim mourns for them means Ephraim, the persona. We're talking about the generation of Ephraim's children or grandchildren. And he's mourning for them. Children of stomach. And that's where the Radak leaves it. So let's follow the rationale of the Radak for a moment. And the Radak has one problem that he's addressed, which is Ephraim never goes into the land of Israel, so how could they be killed in the land of Israel? Must be that they were killed outside of the land of Israel, either in the Midbar or in Arvot Moav. The question that I have with that is, how were they born in the land of Israel? When Ephraim is born where? In Mitzrayim. If Ephraim is born in Mitzrayim, And we're talking about, let's assume for the moment, his children. They're certainly not born in the land of Israel during the story of Sefer Breshit. Right? Yosef certainly is not going back to Israel before Yaakov comes down to Egypt. So Yaakov comes down to Egypt at the end of Sefer Breshit, and the beginning of Sefer Shemot starts, and they're enslaved. There's a window of time in between. In a window of time, what happened to Bnei Israel? We don't know. But according to the Radak, and based on these psukim, we know the following. We know that at some point Ephraim has children born in the land of Israel. Why? How? Did Ephraim go back to Israel? It means that all of Bnei Israel is sitting in Egypt, living in Egypt, in Eretz Goshen, multiplying and establishing their roots in the land of Egypt. And Ephraim, Yaakov's grandson, Ephraim, at some point, finds himself in the land of Israel having children and building a family. Well, that's not in the story in Chumash. That's in the four lines of blank space between the end of Sefer Breshit and the beginning of Sefer Shemot. It goes even further. Because if, in fact, that is the case, let's take the next pasuk, which the Radak doesn't address. And that is Ephraim's daughter, who builds in essentially what seems to be, in the context of the psukim, in memorial to her two brothers who were killed, builds three cities. Beit Choron Elyon, Beit Choron Tachton, and Uzun She'era, all in the area around Shechem. Which is in Har Ephraim, by the way. And the territorial area that belongs to Ephraim later on. When does she do that? Considering the fact that we're talking about Ephraim's children, they're only in Egypt 210 years. During what period of time are the children of Ephraim building cities in the area of Shechem? And what happened to them? Then they went back to Egypt and joined the rest of Bnei Israel? They're in the land of Israel. They're in the area of Shechem. They're settling in the area of Shechem. They're building cities in the area of Shechem. And then they pick themselves up and leave and come back to the land of Egypt, land of Israel. Or maybe, just maybe, they're building the areas around Shechem, Beit Choron Elyon, Beit Choron Tachton, Uzun She'era, living there, settling there, and staying there. And the rest of Ephraim's family is sitting in Egypt. And maybe, just maybe, there's a section of Bnei Ephraim living in the area around Shechem. And never participating in Shibud Mitzrayim. They never go back to Mitzrayim. She'era builds these three cities and finished. There's an area of Bnei Ephraim here in Har Ephraim, and they live there. Maybe. Why am I biased to this interpretation? Because it explains Ephraim, it explains a number of very strange anomalies in Chumash. And I'll show you what they are. But before I do that, I have to add the sister to this piece. And the sister, or in this case the brother, is the story of Menashe. So Ephraim, we know, assuming I take the Radak at face value, there are children of Ephraim sitting in the area of Shechem. By the way, when the Torah says to, when Moshe instructs Yehoshua, the Torah instructs Moshe when they come into the land of Israel, and they have to create a ceremony of blessings and curses and enact a whole reenactment, essentially, of Mamre HaSinai. They go to two mountains called Har Evel and Har Gerizim. So the first thing they're told is, when you enter the land of Israel, the first place you're going to go to is the area of Har Gerizim and Har Evel, which are Shechem. It's a very strange phenomenon. Hundreds of years we've been dreaming about going to Eretz Yisrael. We have this spiritual legacy called Yerushalayim. We'll talk about Yerushalayim and its role later on in the year. And they're told the first place they're going to go to, the very first location that they have to enter into when they're coming to the land of Israel, is Shechem. How did they get to Shechem? Why Shechem? It's even stranger is there's a list of 31 kings that Yeshua conquers. Yeshua conquers 31 kings that are listed in Sefer in Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12. Not one of them, not a one, comes from the area of Shechem. Every other geographic location in the land of Israel, this entire region of Har Ephraim and the area surrounding Shechem, there's not a single battle. They come into the land of Israel here in Yericho. They're going to battle Ai, they're going to battle Yerushalayim, they're going to battle Givon, they're going to battle Beit El, they're going to battle everywhere around. They're going to take a march, a one-day journey. They're going to march all the way up to Shechem and then all the way back to Yericho without so much as a skirmish. And the great mystery of Sefer Yehoshua, one of the great mysteries the Mepharshim ask, is how did they get up to Shechem and back? And why Shechem? Leave that question open for a moment. Use your imagination. Let's talk about Menashe for a second. Another mystery of Menashe. Moshe Rabbeinu was coming in with Bnei Yisrael from the east, 40 years after they leave Egypt. And he encounters a battle with a man by the name of Sichon, king of Amori. And he engages Sichon, king of Amori, in a battle that takes place in this region here, south of the Arbok River, north of the Arnon River. In the area of Cheshbon and Yatza, all of these areas here, and Aroer. I'll show you the list of cities in a second. Parshat Chukat, it says that after he finished battling Sichon, and Sichon starts up with him, remember. And he has no intention of battling Sichon, they just want to go into the land of Israel, they have no issues with Sichon. Please let Na'abor Na'be'artzecha, let us go through your land. We're passing through. We're interested in going here. We have to get through here, so do me a favor and just get out of my way. We won't start up with you. Derech HaMelech Nelech, we'll take the king's highway. We'll leave you alone. Sichon says, no, you're not coming through my land except over my dead body. Moshe says, not a problem, we can comply. And they go to war, and Sichon gets his way. And they end up taking this whole region. Right? Then, open up the Parshat Chukat for a second. I went up to Parshat Chukat. I'll show you one of the great mysteries. And Parshat Chukat, I'll tell you where I am exactly. Bamidbar. Bamidbar. We get there, we'll get to all the references. This way you sort of pick up the... which parak? I'll show you in a second. Give me a moment. Oh, chapter 21. Chapter 21. Vayishlach Yisrael malachim al Sichon. Verse 21. Starting with verse 21. Vayishlach Yisrael malachim al Sichon malach Amori lemor. Israel sent messengers to Sichon, king of Amori, saying, Ebra be'artzecha lo nite b'sadeh uvecherem. We want to go through your land. We don't want to go right or left. We're not going to go off the road. Lo nishtame be'er. We're not going to take water from the well. B'derech ha-melech nilech. We're going to stay on the king's highway, by the way. B'derech ha-melech doesn't just mean, I don't know, derech ha-melech. Derech ha-melech is the name of a road. Okay? It's called, in English, it's called King's Highway. Right? We got one too, but lots of countries did. It was essentially the main road that went north-south along the Jordan River Valley, or the Syrian African Rift, as it's often called, like straight through the valley. It's a major trade route called Derech HaMelech. It goes from Syria all the way down to the Dead Sea. Actually, it goes from Mesopotamia, from the Euphrates, all the way down to the Dead Sea. It just follows the river all the way down, and then down into the Gulf. No, Abraham comes along from the north, from Haran, and comes down Israel from the north, which is why it gets to Shechem first. If you're taking Derech HaMelech, you're coming up this way. Moshe and the people are camped here on the Arnon River, and he's making the offer to Sichon that they'll take Derech HaMelech right up the coast and straight into Yericho. And that's the that's where the battle takes place, right on Nachal Arnon. Pasuk Chav Gimel. V'lo natan Sichon el Yisrael avor bikvulo. Sichon doesn't let him do it. Yisichon gathers all his forces together. They get to a city called Yatza, and there the battle takes place. Israel smites Sichon by the sword. Now listen carefully. He takes the entire territory of Sichon. Me Arnon ad Yabok. Sichon's territory is circumscribed by two rivers, the Arnon in the south, the Yabok in the north. That's not insignificant. I'll show you why in a moment. That's the territorial area that belonged to Sichon. It originally belonged to Moab. Sichon took it from Moab. Israel conquered it from Sichon. Ad b'nei Amon, ki az gvu b'nei Amon. He stops here at the border of Amon, on the east side, because the border of Ammon was very strong, and he doesn't start up with Ammon. Israel takes the cities, and they begin to dwell in the cities. What are the cities? So here are the list of the cities of Sichon that we conquer. Cheshbon, and the Environs. Cheshbon was the capital city of Emori. Skip the whole story of Cheshbon. Skip down a few psukim. Go down to pasuk lamed. Vaniram avad cheshbon ad divon. The cities that were lost. Cheshbon. I can't write and do this again. Okay. Cheshbon, divon, v'nashim, nofach, medva. Everybody see where I am? Verse 30. Right, the names of the cities: Cheshbon, Divon, Nashim, Nofach, Medva. Vayeshiv Yisrael be'eretz Emori. Vayishlach Moshe l'argelet Ya'azer v'yilkudu b'natera. Then they dwell there. They take Ya'azer as well. And they conquer Ya'azer as well. Okay, let's add Ya'azer to the list. So far, where are we? We are everywhere between Arnon and Yabok. Where is Moshe headed? Gilgal. Yericho. Are we there? We're right there. Moshe is now sitting here. Cheshbon, new capital of the eastern bank of the Jordan River. Moshe's brought his entire army here, wiped out Sichon and his army. He's taken over all the cities. Cheshbon, Divon, Yatza, Nashim, Nofach, Medva, Ya'azer. All the cities are here. Everybody with me? Here's the mystery. Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Vayifnu v'ya'alu derech habashan. Moshe turns and he goes up to the Bashan. Vayetze Og melech Bashan likratam hu v'chalamo lemechama adrei, and Og, king of Bashan, and all of his people come out to wage war with him towards Edrei. Vayomer Hashem, Moshe, God says to Moshe, don't be afraid. As I gave you Sichon, I'll give you Og. Kills Og, captures this, wages war, is victorious over Og. Ad hish bilti hish ilo sarit. No survivors. Pasuk Chav Bet, Perek Chav Bet, Pasuk Aleph, next chapter, verse 1. Vayisu b'nei Yisrael v'yachanu b'arvot Moav, me'evel Yarden Yericho. Israel went, camped opposite Yarden Yericho in Arvot Moav. Can somebody please tell me where the Bashan is? Or what the Bashan is known as today? Bashan is the Ramat Golan, Golan Heights, or Mount Hermon. Moshe's sitting here, conquers Sichon, and then says, oh, you know what, let's just do one more battle, just to kind of secure our borders a little bit. Conquer the Bashan, deal with Og, and we'll go back. Why on earth would he do that? You're sitting in Avot Moab, you just wiped out Sichon, you headed into Yericho, you're going to need to bother with the Golan Heights now? Of all places. He needs to go all the way up north. You know what kind of a distance it is to move the army of Israel all the way up to the Bashan? And then he's frightened by it. God has to come to him and he says, don't be afraid, don't worry. He's frightened by this battle against Bashan. So why start there? Why go there? What does he need it for? He's done. He's conquered Sichon, he's brought the people to the boundary of the land of Israel. It's done. It's over. Let's go.
What are you talking about here?
We don't know. We don't know. We don't have a clue. Let's go one step further. Jump to Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32 of Bamidbar. Show you another mystery. This one you're, this mystery you're familiar with, but we're going to offer a very different answer to the classic answer.
Are you out of Chukat?
Yes, we're out of Chukat. We're now into Matot. Bamidbar, chapter 32. Remember the dialogue with Reuven and Gad? Remember the dialogue with Reuven and Gad? Two tribes, they want to stay Ever Hayad, and they want to stay on the east side of the Jordan. Where do they want to stay? Area taken from Sichon. Reuven and Gad. Right? Reuven, Gad. That's the tribal area that belongs to Reuven and Gad. That's what they were given. How does the story begin? Chapter 32. Umikne Rav Haya Livne Reuven V'Livne Gad Atzum Me'od. Reuven and Gad, they've got land galore. They've got cattle galore. They've got grazing, they've got sheep and cattle. They need grazing land. Vayir'u et eretz ya'azer v'et eretz gil'ad v'ineh makom mikneh. They took a look at the area of Ya'azer, which is here in the center of the area, and the area of the southern Gilad, which is this, the mountains of the Gilad come down from the Bashan. There's the northern Gilad, and then there's a little piece of it that cuts into the tribal area of Gad called the southern part of the Gilad. And they saw that it was good, open grazing field. They come to Moshe and they say, they start listing cities. Listen to the list of cities. Atarot, V'divon, V'ya'azer, V'nimra, V'cheshbon, V'el Ale, Usvam, Unavo, Uva'on. List of cities. Some of them should be familiar to you. Cheshbon, Divon, Ya'azer. Familiar to us. We just dealt with them. The rest of the cities are in the same area. Ha'aretz sheika Hashem lifnei ha'edah lifnei adak Yisrael eretz miknehi ula avadech mikneh. This is perfect territory for us. Let's stay here. The dialogue with Bnei Reuven and God I'm going to skip for now because it's irrelevant, but Moshe gets very upset with them. Why? He says it can right, your brothers are going to go to war, you're going to stay here. Well, that's not nice. So they said, well, that was never our intent. We intended to go and fight and then come back. So Moshe says, fine, if that's what you want to do, gesundheit. The entire parak is a dialogue with whom? The entire parak is a dialogue with Reuven, between Moshe and Reuven and God. Menashe is not in the dialogue. Menashe is not in the conversation. He's not in the equation. Until jump down to verse 33. Right, there's a long dialogue here. There's a negotiation. There's a requirement that they go chalutz. By the way, the requirement that they go first was a requirement that he imposed on Reuven and Gad. because that requirement is articulated in all of these psukim that we skip. Menashe is not in the discussion. At no point does he impose on Menashe a requirement that they go first. Fascinating. That requirement was imposed on Reuven and Gad. Why not on Menashe? Vayiten lehem Moshe. Now listen carefully. Verse 33. Vayiten lehem Moshe livnei Gad livnei Reuven v'lachatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef. He gives Reuven Gad a half of Menashe ben Yosef. Where did Menashe ben Yosef come into the picture? And he gives them et mamlechet Sichon melech Emori v'et mamlechet Og melech Bashan. He gives them the kingdom of Sichon and the kingdom of Og. How did the kingdom of Og get into the picture? They asked for the area of the Abok and the Arnon. They asked for the area of Sichon. Ha'aretz le'areha b'gvulot arei ha'aretz saviv. These are the names of the cities that they were given. Now listen, watch what happens. Vayivnu b'nei Gad. B'nei Gad go and they settle and build the cities, namely Divon, Atarot, Aroer, Atot Shofan, Ya'azer, Yogbaha, Beit Nimra, Beit Haran, Arei Mifza, Gidvotzon, ובני ראובן בנו את חשבון ואת אל עלה ואת קרייתיים ואת נבו ואת ברמאון. All the names of the cities, they're all, trust me, in this area here. Reuven and Gad are given the territorial region between the Abok and the Arnon. And the list of all the cities that they went and they built. Now read, listen, watch carefully with me. We're going to read a pasuk that is going to be the center point of a major controversy. Pasuk Lamed Tet, 39. Vayelchu b'nei Machir ben Menashe Gilada. The children of Machir ben Menashe go to Gilad. Vayelkedua, and they conquer it. Vayoresh et Hamori asher ba, and they remove the Amorites from there. Vayiten Moshe et Hagilad leMachir ben Menashe. And Moshe gives the Gilad to Machir ben Menashe. Oh, Yeshua. And he dwells therein. The Ya'ir ben Menashe. Now, where did he come from? Ya'ir ben Menashe halach vayilkod et chavotehem. He went and he conquers all of the plains of the area of the Gilad. Vayikra eten chavot Ya'ir. And they're called the plains of Ya'ir. Novach halach vayikod et knat et mnoteh vayikol et novach kishmol. That's not my issue. Chavot Ya'ir are here. The area of Malchut Og goes from here, from the Chermon, down to the Yabok. So let's understand this for a second. He gives Reuven and Gad this much land, two tribes. And he gives half of Shevet Menashe that much land. Is that fair? Is that fair? He takes an about face to go all the way up to the Gilad for some strange reason. And he comes back down. He's dialoguing with Reuven and Gad. Reuven and Gad say, we want this territory. He says, fine, you can have it. And I'm going to give half of Menashe the rest of it. Where did that come in? And then on top of it, we have the conquest of the cities of Chavot Ya'ir by a man by the name of Ya'ir ben Menashe. Ya'ir ben Menashe. Ya'ir ben Menashe. For him to conquer Chavot Ya'ir, he's got to be a pretty old guy. So Taka, there's a medrash in the Seder Olam Rabba that says that Ya'ir ben Menashe is something like several hundred years old. Ya'ir ben Menashe u'machir ben Menashe noldu b'chaye Yaakov Avinu. They are born in the days of Yaakov, and they die after the death of Moshe. So says the Medrash. Why does the Medrash say that? Because the pasuk in Bereishit says, "Gam b'nei Machir ben Menashe yaldu al b'kei Yosef," because the children of Machir ben Menashe and Ya'ir ben Menashe are born in the days of Yosef. So if Ya'ir ben Menashe is going and conquering the land of Chavot Ya'ir as they're entering into the land of Israel, considering the fact that Ya'ir ben Menashe is the grandson of Yosef, and Yosef, and he sat on Yosef's knees, he's got to be a pretty old man. Correct? Unless. Let me ask you a different question. Unless it's a different grandson, that's possible. But Yair ben Menashe, okay. I'll give you another possibility. Why is the area called Gilad? Always referred to as the Gilad. Why is it called Gilad?
The name of the
son was not Gilad. Is Ezer and Elad. Why is it called Gilad? Actually, the name Gilad comes from the first place the word Gilad appears in Chumash. It is the Hebrew name of the monument that Yaakov and Lavan erect on Yaakov's return from the house of Lavan. Yaakov calls it Gal-Ed, and Yosef and Lavan calls it Yagar Sahaduta, which is here on the border of the Yabok River. Right? The Yabok is the river that Yaakov crosses when he returns and he fights the Ish. Right? An area called Machanayim. That's the first place. That monument is called Gal-Ed, which is essentially the same as Gil-Ad. But take a look. Let's go back to Divrei HaYamim. Going back to Divrei HaYamim, Chronicles. Let's go back to Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim Aleph. Okay, let's look at two quick sources. One is chapter 2. Chapter 2 is actually the lineage of Yehuda. Yehuda and Menashe, by the way, are mechutanim. Right? They marry into each other's families. Not the issue for now, but it is a fact. Take a look at chapter 2, starting with verse 21. V'achabach Chetzron. Chetzron is grandson of Yehuda, right? Son of Peretz. If you remember the story of Peretz, Peretz is one of the two children born to Yehuda and Tamar. He has a son by the name of Chetzron. So we're talking about Yehuda's grandson. Chetzron marries Bat Machir Avi Gilad. He marries a man by the name of Machir, which is Machir ben Menashe. So he marries Machir, the daughter of Machir ben Menashe, Avi Gilad, father of Gilad. And they have a child by the name of Skuv. Skuv has a holid et Yair. Skuv has, right, so Chetzron's grandson, or Gilad's, no, Machir's daughter's grandson, is a man by the name of Yair, Vahilo 23 arim be'eretz ha-Gilad. And he has 30 cities in the area of the Gilad. What generation are we talking about? Menashe. Machir ben Menashe is born in the days of Yosef. The daughter of Machir ben Menashe marries Chetzron, and their grandson has 30 cities in the area of the Gilad. What generation are we? Not if you include post-Yosef. What generation are we? Let's go one step further. Take a look at chapter 7. Children of Menashe, Asriel Asheyelada, first child name of Asriel, Pilagsho Ha'aramiya, Yalda et Machir Avigilad. He has a Pilagish by the name of Aramiya, which comes from the word Aram. He has a Pilagish from the area of Aram, so the Aramean Pilagish, has a child by the name of Machir Avigilad. So the grandson of Menashe is called Gilad. So why is Machir, why is Yosef, why is Menashe's grandson called Gilad? Coincidence? The entire region is called Gilad because of Machir's son by the name of Gilad. What happened here? The rest of the names I'm going to skip of all the children. Actually, there's a list of the children of Gilad. Ela b'nei Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe. Then he has a sister. He also has children. And at the very end, the last sentence there, verse 19, Vayu b'nei Shmida achyan v'shechem v'lichi v'aniyam. Name one of the children, the name of Shechem. One of his grandchildren is named Shechem. Why are they naming all their children after the area of Gilad and Shechem? So what's the solution to our mystery? How do I have Ya'ir ben Menashe, grandson who was born in the days of Yosef, conquering cities in Chavot Ya'ir, in the area of the Gilad, which is named Gilad after, or vice versa, Machir ben Menashe's grandson? Why does Moshe throw in half of Shevet Menashe into the equation of the settlement of the eastern bank of the Jordan River when they're not part of the equation and not part of the dialogue? And he doesn't impose on them the requirement of conquering the land of Israel first. Unless they are already there. Whoa. Take a deep breath. Because you know, you understand what you've just suggested. Take a deep breath. And let's walk it through for a minute. In Pashat Chukat, I didn't emphasize this, but if you take a look at the Pasuk, after this, I'm not going to have time to explain the grammatical nuance. If you are familiar with it, good. If not, we'll come back to it at another time. The Pasuk says, V'ya'ir ben Menashe lakach et chavotehem. Past perfect tense. In the context of the story of Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe, it doesn't say that Ya'ir ben Menashe went and conquered the area of Chavot Ya'ir. It says Ya'ir ben Menashe had gone and conquered the area of Chavot Ya'ir. In other words, Menashe's grandchildren, by the name of Gilad, are settling in the area of the Golan, are settling in the area of the Gilad, are settling in a territorial area which will eventually become half of the tribe of Menashe. And when Moshe divides up the conquest of Sichon and Og, he gives the conquest of Sichon to Reuven and Gad because they asked for it. And the conquest of Og, he gives to half of Menashe. Why? Because they're already there. They've been sitting there and waiting for 200 years, 400 years, however long Yetziat Mitzrayim took. Menashe's grandchildren go and settle in the area of Ya'ir, of Chavot Ya'ir, 30 cities in the region. Ya'ir ben Menashe, in the area of the Gilad. They're sitting there. Og, king of the Bashan, comes and takes over the territory, subdues them, conquers them, whatever they are, but they're living under the grandchildren of Menashe, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren of Menashe, sitting under the rule of Og. Moshe brings Bnei Yisrael up to the Yabok River. He's sitting here with his army, takes an about face, goes all the way up north and conquers Og, and in so doing, I will use a modern political term, liberates the grandchildren of Menashe who have been sitting there for so many generations. Mystery. When Bnei Yisrael leave Egypt, Shevet Menashe is 32,500 in the census of Pashat Bamidbar. When they come to the Avot, when they come to Pashat Pinchas, and they're sitting on the entrance of the boundaries of the land of Israel, after Pashat Chukat, right? But Pinchas is later. The size of Shevet Menashe is 52,700. Where did they grow from? Everybody else stays equal. Shevet Menashe jumps by 30%. Another case, Shevet Ephraim. Shevet Ephraim is one of the smallest tribes. When they leave Egypt, they're 40,500. In Parshat Pinchas, Shevet Ephraim is 32,500. Reduction in numbers? Take a look for a moment in Yehoshua, chapter 17. Verse 14. Chapter 17, verse 14. Yeshua, chapter 17. We have to do some Yeshua today, otherwise people are going to wonder. Vayidabru b'nei Yosef el Yeshua lemor b'nei Yosef come to Yeshua. B'nei Yosef are Ephraim and the other half of Manasseh. מדוע נתת לי נחלה גורל אחד וחבל אחד ואני עם רב אשר עד כה ברכה נישא? Why would you give me only one portion of land? I am the largest. I am one of the largest tribes in Israel. ויאמר להם יהושע, אם עם רב אתה, עלה לך יערה ובראית לך שם בארץ הפריזי והר אפרים, כי עץ לך הר אפרים. Says to Ephraim, if you're so many, and Har Ephraim isn't large enough for you, so go eastward and go into the Yar Ephraim on the east side of the Jordan and go take a portion of land in the area of the Galad, and you can have that too. I gave the other half to Manasseh, you might as well take a section. So Ephraim goes from being the smallest tribe in Parshat Pinchas, 32,000, within 3 or 4 or 5 years, to becoming to coming to Moshe Rabbeinu and complaining, there's too many of us, we can't live here in Har Ephraim. Unless B'nai Ephraim, in the days of Uzin She'era, from the daughter of She'era, B'nai Ephraim are sitting in the area of the region of Shechem. And B'nai Manasseh are sitting in the region of the Gilad. Because Yosef taught his children from the day he went down to Egypt. God will take you out of this land. Yosef's children are the only one born in exile. Yosef's children, Ephraim and Manasseh, learned on their father's knees that our homeland is in the land of Israel. And he taught his children, you go to Israel. And it could very well be that because Yosef was the viceroy of Egypt, his children had more freedom than the rest of Bnei Israel did. So while the rest of the tribes are sitting in Eretz Goshen, Ephraim and Manasseh are free to wander. And you know where they wander? They wander back to the land of Israel. And they settle in the tribal regions that will ultimately become theirs. The tribe, the area of around Shechem, which is Har Ephraim, and the area of the Gilad, which will belong to Manasseh. And the story of the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is the story of the reunification of the tribes of Israel. It's not a conquest. We were there first. We're in the land of Shechem, and we're in the area of the Gilad. I'll go one step further. One of the great mysteries is why Moshe is constantly reenacting the Brit of Har Sinai. Comes to Avot Moav, and he repeats the whole thing of Har Sinai. He goes through the Ten Commandments again in Avot Moav, in the beginning of Sefer Dvarim. Sefer Dvarim is a repeat of the entire Torah. He goes through all the mitzvot. He goes through a reenactment of the Brit. The Tochacha, Bahar B'chukotai, is repeated in Parshat Ki Tavo, all of the admonitions and the blessings and curses. What are we doing it for? And it says, this is the words of the Brit that Moshe enacted with Bnei Yisrael, besides the Brit that he made with them at Choreb. What do I need the Brit for a second time? Then they go into the land of Israel, they go up to Har Shechem, they go up to Har Gerizim and Har Evel, and within the same number of years, within the same month, they do it all over again. Blessings and curses, one mountain and the other mountain. We're a month later. They do it all over again. Why? Because Bnei Manasseh didn't stand at Sinai. And Bnei Ephraim didn't stand at Sinai. So we need to reunite all the tribes of Israel. I need to reunite them by reenacting the covenant at Sinai with Bnei Manasseh in Arvot Moav and with Bnei Ephraim in the area of Shechem. And the story of Sefer Yehoshua is not the story of a conquest, it's the story of a reunification of the tribes of Israel. And is it a surprise, therefore, that the tribe chosen to lead Bnei Israel are the children of Yosef, the only one of the 12 tribes, to instill in his children that despite living in Egypt, and despite the Sheba in Egypt, and when all the other tribes are trying to assimilate into Egyptian culture and into Egyptian society, Yosef's children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, are building cities in the land of Israel. 30 cities in Chavot Ya'ir, the area around Shechem. and when a successor to Moshe is chosen, he's chosen Dafka from Bnei Ephraim, and the children of Yosef. That is the beginning of our study. That is our introduction, Bezrat Hashem. Next week, we start Sefer Yoshua.